at alcavision.com.
Hi, everybody. Kate Delaney, America Tonight. Very thrilled to be broadcasting from the United Nations Radio Day. We've talked to some fascinating people, and we're excited about our next guest because it seems like he's been anywhere and everywhere. That's like my fantasy. Patrick McCormick joins us now. He's been working for UNICEF, and let me just tell you what he's doing because we want to get specific here. He's covering emergencies since 94. So the very first emergency, the tragedy in Rwanda. He's also been to Somalia, the Balkans, Sierra Leone, and the list of countries goes on and on. And recently he's been to Haiti. Patrick, welcome to ATN.
Thank you very much. One country you didn't mention is DPRK, which is... Not many people have been there.
No kidding. Actually, since you brought that up first, let's start there. What can you tell us about DPRK?
Well, I was there some time ago now. It was one of my first missions, and it was even more secretive then than it is now. That's kind of hard to believe, but... And it was just at the beginning of the problems they've been having now, reoccurring every year, of severe food shortages. And I went out into the countryside and saw children who were, you know, were severely malnourished. And as we know, this is something which, for various reasons, is happening now on a yearly basis.
So when you see something like that, I'm sure it just breaks your heart, but you've traveled to some of these amazing places but that have had terrible tragedies. What do you do when you're working on these emergencies? What you're certainly the eyes and you're seeing things. What do you try to do besides raise awareness?
Well, raising awareness is the main reason I'm there, that's for sure. But you get caught up into all sorts of things. I mean, I've given out water, food. I've picked up children abandoned on the sides of roads in Africa, taking them somewhere. I mean, you pitch in. I mean, that's what it's all about. And whatever it takes, whatever you have to do, even if what you're looking at is so enormous, and I never forget once... standing on top of a hill and looking across at the refugee camps of Hutus who had fled Rwanda onto the other side, and it was as far as the eye could see of people, camps, smoke fires, and I just looked at it and thought, my goodness, you know, how is that going to ever be resolved? And the situation in that part of the world is still unresolved, as a matter of fact. It is heartbreaking often. But, I mean, I wouldn't swap this job for anything in the world.
Yeah. You mentioned the Rwanda thing. Was that had to be frustrating, what you just described, because you're trying to, I'm sure, rattle cages in a sense to say, listen, do you understand what's going on here? And that had to be an awful thing to see how that was resolved. Thank goodness, at least Rwanda has moved forward somewhat, but I think some people had no idea how bad it was. And you're a former journalist, so you probably, I'm sure, were trying to get people to raise the awareness on this. Was that tough for you?
I mean, Rwanda was fascinating and terrible in equal measures. It was probably the first really kind of televised emergency. I mean, everybody was there. I remember, you know. I didn't have to go and find media to tell them what we were doing. They came to us.
Right.
And it was in a country which I bet you most people had never heard of before.
Sure.
Even knew where it was. Tiny little place. Nothing much had happened there. Suddenly an explosion of the most ferocious magnitude. In a matter of months, 600,000, 700,000 people killed. Such a small country, they all know each other. I mean, the whole thing was horrendous. Now, Rwanda, as you say, has moved forward incredibly well, but the problems still exist on the borders in Congo, which it seems to be a never-ending fight between various rebel groups, between remnants from that conflict, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So from a tiny country, which has moved forward to one of the biggest in Africa, Congo, DRC Congo, which has got the most tremendous problems.
And I mentioned, I mean, there's so many fascinating things we could talk with you about, so we're very pleased to be sitting here with Patrick McCormick, who has, like I said, really seen the world. Haiti and what's happened in Haiti. There are several people that I know that have gone there that say, whoa, you know, so many different tragedies bubble up in so many emergencies that we can't forget about what's going on in Haiti. Where do you think we are with Haiti?
Well, first of all, I have to correct you. I didn't actually go down there. I was just about to go with our executive director, and the mission got cancelled because there were riots, etc., etc. However, I mean, I know through eyes of my colleagues who were there that, I mean, a country which before the earthquake,
right,
buildings fell down just because they were so badly constructed. They went through two typhoons or cyclones, I don't remember, hurricane storms in
sure.
a row. It's desperately poor. You know, before the quake, half of the people didn't, you know, half the children didn't have access to school, to water. Ironically, a lot of people are probably better off now in those sort of terms than they were before the quake, just because of the amount, the huge amount of aid and assistance that's gone in there. I mean,
right.
the outpouring of money, of human resources, and it's dwarfed anything we've seen since the tsunami.
Right, right.
I mean, much more, though, for example, than the flooding in Pakistan.
Right.
It ticked every box of an emergency. And so, you know, the only way I can look at it with some sort of measure of hope is this is the chance. They're not going to get another one. They can't blow it. We can't blow it to rebuild a country which is halfway decent for the children, especially, because it's never been anything but a disaster.
Right.
So now they've got the money. They've got the people. Let's do it.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. In your role with UNICEF and emergencies, how do you you must have a list, because there's so many things happening. We've just really kicked it around in a couple of different places. That's only scratching the surface. Do you figure out, okay, this is, we got to really beef it up here, then we got to go to number two, we got to go to number three. How do they prioritize that? How do you prioritize the emergencies?
Well, we kind of characterize them by, you know, the sudden onset. That's the earthquake.
Right.
That happens in heartbeat.
Right.
And if it's big, it's big.
Right.
They're the long-standing emergencies, like DRC Congo, like Somalia, like Chad, like Central African Republic, which just go on and on and on. I mean, we're even seeing, you know, recently Libya, for example, is beginning to look like a protracted emergency. There's no quick, like, okay, we're over now, we can get on with the peace building or whatever situation. It's still kind of a stalemate. And those things can just drag on and on and on and on, because neither side have got exactly the right amount of muscle to beat the others. And so we're still standing on the sidelines a little bit.
Sure.
Getting attention for the sudden onset emergencies is, and money and the funding and all the expertise we need to fix that, is relatively easy. For the ones that just have been going on and on and on and on, it's much more difficult. People, you know, donor fatigue sets in. Well, they never can get it right. It's too difficult. Where's the progress? And in a sense, you have to think, yeah, you know, but we're there and we're doing what we can.
Well said. Patrick McCormick, what a great way to end this interview. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fellas, are you looking to spice things up in the bedroom? Been fantasizing about surprising your lover with an adventurous new toy or adult movie? Well, here's an offer you won't be able to resist. Go to adamandeve.com, and for a limited time only, you'll get 50% off just about any item. But that's not all. Oh, no. When you select your one item at 50% off, you'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs for a little inspiration. Plus, a free extra gift so sensual, we can't mention it on the radio. And to top it all off, we'll even throw in free shipping on your entire order. And no, we're not teasing. So check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Get 50% off one item when you type DEAL21 for the offer code upon checkout. When you do, you'll get 3 free DVDs, a free extra gift, and free shipping. Just use offer code DEAL21 at AdamandEve.com.
As many people know, ever since President Nixon took us off the gold standard, the U.S. dollar has been devaluating. What people don't know, however, is how this directly affects your personal finances. Is there a way to protect your portfolios from losing value? The answer to all of this is gold and silver. They both have maintained their purchasing power for 6,000 years. If you had $100,000 in cash and $100,000 in gold and silver back in 1913 and kept them until now, your cash would have the buying power of only $4,800. But your gold and silver would have the buying power of $3 million. The answer to protecting your assets is simple. Call John Ballman today at 1-800-686-2237, extension 169. Get all your questions answered before your money is worth a zero. Call 1-800-686-2237, extension 169. Take action today while we still accept paper dollars for gold. That's 1-800-686-2237, extension 169.
Have you ever heard of a pharmacist who discourages the use of most prescription drugs? Well, pharmacist Ben Fuchs is that person, and boy, is he fascinating. He's a nutritional pharmacist and skincare specialist who operates out of Boulder, Colorado. And to hear this man speak is nothing less than inspiring, because he's charismatic and makes a lot of sense. He asks, why take dangerous drugs when all your body needs to stay healthy is all natural with no side effects? Pharmacist Ben sees the human body as a healing and regenerating system, divinely designed to heal and renew itself on a moment-to-moment basis. But it needs nutrition and nutritional supplementation. Ben says you've got to be on a nutritional supplement program if you want to be healthy in 21st century America. And he wants to help people get off the toxic drug treadmill and get on a good nutritional supplement program. I support what pharmacist Ben is saying and doing to help America get healthier. And I urge you to watch and listen to Ben deliver his powerful message at your convenience. Just go to AmericaTonightTeam.com. That's AmericaTonightTeam.com.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to America Tonight. I am pleased as punch to be broadcasting from the UN. Actually, just a stone's throw away from the, I call it the mothership. I'm in the UNICEF area, very important area, of course, of the UN. And I'm sitting here with a very important man. His name is Dan Shepherd, and he's with the Sustainable Development, ready for this, Focal Point Information Officer, Strategic Communications Division. There's got to be some crazy acronym for that. I mean, it's an obvious one, but we got to come up with one for Dan. Dan, welcome to the show, and thanks for stopping by.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's jump right into this. Talking about sustainable development, this is a huge area in a lot of different countries, certainly. We think of third world countries, but what about big countries like India and China with the kinds of population that you're talking about? Do you work with those countries as well?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, sustainable development's for all countries, rich, poor, big, little. It's about how countries move forward. How do you create prosperity, economic prosperity? How do you improve people's quality of life? How do you do it while protecting the environment? And you can do all three at the same time. And the problems that each country faces are different. The circumstances are different. But basically, the ingredients are the same. And yes, some countries, big countries like India, China, they have, you know, huge populations, well over a billion, and they have to contend with finding jobs for people, moving people out of poverty, and improving their lives and doing it without wrecking their environment.
Yeah.
And that's a huge task.
Yeah, and when you say it's a huge task, I mean, obviously, as you're trying to move mountains, what is it that you need? What is it you seek when you're talking about going in and figuring out strategically what people need?
Well, I mean, everybody needs some basic stuff. Water, energy, food, shelters, livable cities. These are sort of the building blocks and jobs. Every country has to figure out how they can do this all at the same time. And to do this, you have to mobilize government policies. You have to mobilize your private sector. You have to mobilize your civil society people, education, health. There's a broad array, and it all feeds into the same goal, and that's, you know, moving countries and peoples forward.
So with this kind of a goal, is there some kind of a map? Is there a roadmap that you try to go by? Like, okay, here's our focal point now for this month, for this 6 months, for whatever. Or no, you kind of just have those tentacles out there and you're trying to grab as much as possible.
Well, that's an interesting question. There is sort of a guide to all of this, and all countries have agreed to it. 20 years ago, at the Earth Summit, countries agreed to something called Agenda 21, and that spells out what all the sustainable development is, what are the steps countries need to do. And right now, we're at a time when countries are actually looking what has worked and what hasn't, and for what hasn't, why hasn't it worked. And next year, the world is going to have this 20-year follow-up in Rio de Janeiro, called Rio Plus 20, where they're going to look at how do you take this whole agenda forward. And the challenges were all known 20 years ago, but now they're being felt, like in ways never felt before. When people talked about climate change then, it was sort of out there in the future. Now the impacts are being felt. The science is more certain. They talked about the need to conserve biodiversity and natural ecosystems then. But now we're losing species at an unprecedented rate. We're finding that our natural capital, the things nature gives us for free, like water, wood, things from the forest, and food, they're all compromised now. And if we're going to feed, if we're going to feed the world's population, we're going to hit 7 billion people at the end of October. And that's not the end of it. The population is still going to rise after that. We need to take note of all of this and figure out solutions on what we do.
Yeah, how concerned are you that people don't realize it? We talk about that on America Tonight, and we've had other guests that talk about, well, you might have to start thinking about survival things. And when I say survival things, just even things about here in the United States, being able to grow things, being able to do what you have to do, maybe into the future, if more people aren't paying attention to what you just said. So the red flags are there. Do you think people are paying attention to that?
Well, increasingly, yes. In various countries, governments are moving, some faster than others. There still needs to be a lot more awareness around the world. I still think a lot of people think some of these things are just random natural events and chalk it up to acts of, you know, nature, things like that, when in fact they are what is being predicted. Like, for instance, the climate change scientists, they can't say that any weather event is attributed to climate change itself. You don't know that a hurricane is a climate change, but you have patterns. When you have more droughts or more intense precipitation, bigger storms and things like that, that is consistent with what they've been saying. And we're seeing the pattern, you know, fit more and more. So a lot of people still haven't gotten it, but I think more and more you see countries, you see businesses moving into markets for green things, mm-hmm. For green solutions, and they're not just doing it because they, you know, think it's nice. They think there's money there. They think that there's markets, and they think that's the future.
So besides this, talking about green solutions, what are some of the, with the food especially, what do you think has to happen with food?
Well, a number of things. First of all, land around the world, you have to pay attention to how land is used. Is it being used in the right way for the right purpose? Are the right crops being grown in the right spots? Do people have ownership rights of land? Do they have incentive to take care of the land? Farmland is one of poses a lot of environmental hazards in terms of nutrient runoff from farms in the Mississippi Delta. You have all these dead zones in the oceans and in the Gulf, and that's all valuable. That's all valuable fertilizer that we're losing, and we're killing our waters. So, I mean, we're doing damage on a number of fronts that could limit our food supply, when in fact, if we think about it and do things differently, we can have our seafood, we could have our land-based agricultural crops, we could expand. The world could probably feed more people, but another big problem is getting the food to the people who need it. Distribution accounts for bad distribution accounts for most of the people who are suffering from a lack of nutrition and things like that. Other issues are really, you know, up for grabs in terms of debate, genetically modified food and things like that. There's a lot of disagreement on that here at the UN. We haven't come to any
decisions on what you think should happen.
I think people still believe that, you know, using traditional agricultural methods, we can feed the world. But it has to be done rationally, it has to be done sensibly, and using the best agricultural methods known.
Yeah, we've got a minute or so left, a minute and a half or so left. Doing the job that you do, what's the most rewarding thing for you about your work with the UN, at the UN?
Well, the most rewarding thing is when you work on something that you feel has moved the needle somewhat forward. I mean, these are difficult issues. They're big issues. They need a lot. But I mean, even when you don't get like a binding treaty on climate change, you feel that all the work done on climate change has really energized the discussion. It has raised the discussion to levels that have not been seen before. And that's really important, because that's how change is going to come, when people know what the problem is, know what the possible solutions are, and can choose for what they think is best.
Yeah. How big is this conference in Rio? Rio plus 20.
Yes. It's going to be big. I mean, it will be, there are all sorts of estimates, 20,000 to 30,000 people.
Dan Shepherd, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
GCN listeners, why have you been hearing so much about Dermatol, the all-natural, all-purpose first aid spray? Because it's the must-have first aid product you need in your preparedness kit. Dermatol is made in America by Americans who know there's a more affordable, natural way to treat cuts, burns, bites, rashes, shingles, boils, and many other skin problems. Dermatol is gentle enough for diaper rash, powerful enough for bed sores, and harmless to the eyes and mouth. It's great for the whole family, even your family pets. Dermatol is antimicrobial, antifungal, antiviral, and not diminished by freezing, extreme heat, or years in storage. Dermatol is an absolute must for any first aid or preparedness kit. Dermatol's soothing, rapid restoration of injured skin is so effective, it's guaranteed. Order yours today. Call 800-217-6677. 800-217-6677. That's 800-217-6677. Efficient, economical, effective. Spray it all with Dermatol.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
Food prices are spiraling out of control. In order to survive, you will soon need to produce some or all of your own food in your backyard or small farm. Many years ago, sought-after radio guest Marjorie Wildcraft and her family began working to find the easiest ways to grow food for the crisis we are now facing. Marjorie created a video that is the fastest way to learn how to grow food. You'll learn the most efficient gardening methods, myths and truths of orchards and edible landscaping, effective predator protection, and even home butchering. Everyone is talking about Marjorie's DVD, and it's highly recommended by Jim Rawls, Jack Spurko, and Bountiful Gardens. Read her free reports on how to have a green thumb, making free fertilizer, and answers the question, do you need a gun to garden? If you want the security, savings, and freedom of food self-reliance, buy Marjorie's DVD and get the free reports at backyardfoodproduction.com. Again, that's backyardfoodproduction.com.
Did you know that billions are spent every year just for a simple drink of water? But it's the quality of the water that Americans are concerned with, especially after floods, hurricanes, earthquakes, and other disasters that routinely disrupt and contaminate water supplies. Safe drinking water is too important to leave to chance. That's why you need an AquaRain water filtration system. The American-made AquaRain is an essential survival tool that operates for just pennies per gallon. It lets you retrieve water from lakes, ponds, streams, or rooftops during any disaster and assures you of healthy drinking water. The stainless steel AquaRain's patented space-age ceramic and GAC technology uses microfiltration and gravity to purify water. No chemicals, no electricity, no water pressure needed. And AquaRain's cartridges last for thousands of gallons. AquaRain is hands down the best water filter on the market. Call 800-572-2051 or go to aquarain.com. That's 800-572-2051 or aquarain.com. Every family needs an AquaRain.
The food storage industry leader has done it again.
Introducing FDG Clubs and Survival Bucks from the Freeze-Dry Guy. For over 39 years, the Freeze-Dry Guy has served various government agencies and the private sector with the finest in storable foods and emergency rations. If you've wanted to build emergency food supplies but couldn't afford it,
now you can.
Go to freezedryguy.com, click on products, and look for the Freeze-Dry Guy Clubs to pay as you go.
Now you can build food storage without going into debt.
Choose from a payment range of $95 to $450 per month.
Our clubs work with everyone's budget.
Plus, when you join Freeze Dry Guy Clubs, you'll get additional rewards. For example, this month, get 10% back in survival bucks on all purchases in the Freeze Dry Guy product line, plus free shipping within the lower 48 states on any order amount. Hurry, go to freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-3663. That's freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-3663. The Freeze Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
It's always great to be back in New York, and of course, what a big day here at the UN and broadcasting from the UNICEF facility. And we've been introduced to some very interesting people here and talked about a slew of issues facing the United States and the world. This is a big one for us. I want to introduce you to Jeffrey Shaw. Jeffrey Shaw works with an agency that some of you will recognize that we've talked about before, the IAEA. Am I right?
It's a very punchy title, isn't it?
It is. And what's interesting is I think some of you probably recognize what that stands for. We're talking about atomic...
International Atomic Energy Agency.
Energy, yeah. We're talking about inspections, all kinds of things related to that. And I guess, Jeff, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And my first question is, having talked to some people about Fukushima, we've focused a lot as to the people and what happened there, what's happening now, what's going on with the reactors. Tell us the latest from your point of view of what you know of what's going on at Fukushima.
Yeah, they're still working very hard on stabilizing the reactors. It's still a very serious problem. They're still monitoring the environment and foodstuffs and the marine environment, for example, and we're working very closely with the Japanese government to do that. But what we're looking towards is we have the immediate emergency we're working on, but we're looking ahead to how we're going to learn from this experience, what lessons need to be learned. And what my director general, our organization is based in Vienna,
mm-hmm.
and we're hosting a meeting, a ministerial level meeting in 2 weeks' time in Vienna to look at exactly this issue, to start a process of looking how countries are prepared to deal with emergencies and how we can review the safety framework with a view to strengthening it. So it'll be an ongoing process. We just finished. We just had a team come back from Japan. We put together an international team of experts to go into Japan. They've put a preliminary report, and they'll be reporting to this high-level meeting coming up, as I say, in 2 weeks in Vienna.
In what you've seen, and, I mean, obviously, you're right. You're there in the capacity of advisement, I assume, right, and pulling things together, coordinating?
Yeah, we coordinate the international response.
Mm-hmm.
So we bring together all the UN organizations. We work closely, say, with the World Health Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Meteorological Organization, provide direct assistance to Japan upon their requests. We also try to validate information that Japan gives to us. And so we're on the ground. We've sent missions, as I say, to monitor food, radiation. We've sent teams in to look at the reactor itself. So, but it's very much in partnership with Japan, clearly.
In looking at what's happened there and talking about reviewing responses and whatnot, how big is the concern? Because what happened at Fukushima, the plant and the location of where it is, and talking to several scientists, they said, well, you know, this location, obviously, they want the water and they're using the water, but it's dangerous because knowing of the possibility of tsunamis and earthquakes. Mm. Would that be one of the things that you'll look at in your review and tell, hey, listen, you've got to be concerned about what could possibly happen here with a natural disaster?
We've been working on this issue. It's not a new issue.
Right.
We've been working with member
yeah.
states for some time on this issue. I mean, to put it in perspective, the reactor behaved as it should have. After the enormous earthquake, it shut down. But what the problem was is that their defences against the tsunami, they catered for a 5.7-metre tsunami, and they were overwhelmed for 14 metres of tsunami.
Oh.
So some immediate lessons they'll be learning is, well, how, you know, better defences against that situation, making sure that some of our infrastructure is not on the site, maybe at a higher level, so that, you know, the backup generators, which were flooded, and that's what caused the problems,
mm-hmm.
and the meltdown, they're located higher. So this is something that the experts are getting together, and I don't profess to be an expert, but are getting together and looking at these sort of things. So some practical, immediate, but also longer-term ways of strengthening the safety.
When you talk about putting together people that would be advising in long-term, obviously you have to get the countries to agree to want to be participants in that, which I imagine most are, for the most part. We know the ones that wouldn't be. But the looking at the long-term effects, what, who do you send? Are we talking scientists? Are we talking inspectors? What would a team be that would
well,
come in?
It's peer review. We do a lot of peer reviews. I mean, it would take a treaty if we're looking at some sort of inspector,
yeah.
because you don't have that legal authority. The agency doesn't. What we do is develop standards. We provide expert missions to advise governments on how to develop a safety culture, a safety infrastructure. We send teams in to look at operational aspects or regulatory aspects. But that's bringing together the member states, and that has to be a collaborative effort. And I think all member states who operate reactors are saying, yes, we've looked at our own reactors, let's get together and move ahead and look at how lessons we can learn from this and move ahead.
So there's a definite willingness.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
So as I say, we've got the meeting in Vienna. The Secretary General, United Nations, is also having a meeting in September, the 22nd of September, again, to build on that momentum. So we're starting a process, and it will continue forward for a few years.
Yeah. In looking forward and looking ahead and whatnot, how many, I don't even know the answer to this question. I have sort of a ballpark figure, but how many reactors are we talking about? How many different countries?
Currently there are 29 countries, I think, that operate power reactors, not research reactors, but power reactors. I think there's about 440-odd reactors being used to generate electricity around the world. And I can tell you, before this accident in Japan, we had, over the last 12 months, I think 60 or so countries have come to us and said we would like to start nuclear energy programs. Now, clearly, not all countries are ready for that. And our job, we're not in the business of selling reactors. Our job is to provide modelling, And we provide to assistance to states so they can model what's the best mix of energy for them. And it's technology neutral. And it may be that nuclear is not the option, clearly. But the other message we continually give is that it's a long-term investment in safety, having a safety culture, having a safety regulatory infrastructure in place, having trained people, not just safety, but security and safeguards. All of it, it's a package if it's going to be sustainable.
Right.
And so we continually emphasize this is a long-term investment. It's your sovereign choice. But if you're looking at this as an option, you can't come tomorrow and say, I want to have a nuclear power plant, because it doesn't work that way.
Right.
You have to invest. Invest in all those aspects.
Do you, of some of the nations we're talking about, or some of the places we're talking about, 60, that's significant. Are some of them developing countries,
yeah,
emerging countries?
A lot of countries. Energy security is a critical issue for development.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it underpins all the Millennium Development Goals. Energy.
Sure.
If you don't have energy, you can't develop. So countries are looking at ways to develop energy. And there's a lot of research being done now on small reactors, which may be appropriate for them, where you can come in, you plug in like a nuclear battery, if you will, run it for 10 years and then unplug it and you get it replaced. So clearly a large reactor may not be what's needed, a 1,000-megawatt reactor, but maybe you can have small reactors. And so there's a lot of interest in this area.
Jeff, when you say small reactors, what were you talking about? That's intriguing. I haven't heard that before.
A small reactor would be under 300 megawatts. So a small, and the technology is not new. I mean, small reactors are used in submarines, for example.
Sure, sure, sure.
So it's this nuclear battery concept, and sometimes we're talking, under 100 megawatts of electricity, but sufficient to power a small city, for example, in a developing country which may not have all that infrastructure, and we don't want to have the hassle of it. Or the need for a large reactor.
What do you think the biggest misconception is about nuclear power? Because there's a lot.
Well, I think there are a lot of misconceptions.
Yeah.
I think I could answer that from my perspective,
sure, sure,
working at the agency. The misconceptions is about what our role is.
Right.
A lot of people think we're either A, just selling nuclear power plants, or B, we're just a watchdog. And what we need to think about is that most countries in the world use nuclear technology. Not nuclear power plants, but nuclear technology, either to fight cancer, for example, or to increase crop productions. Or one of the interesting projects we're working on is with water. Drought's a big problem. We've got a project in Africa at the moment, 19 countries working together, helping them manage their water resources using nuclear techniques. You can sink wells in the ground, but how long is that aquifer going to last?
Mm.
What's the size of it? Is it being replenished? Is it sustainable? And that's where we work. Most of our member states, that's what they're interested in. And we're holding a big event on that in September in our general conference, bringing together the world's experts on water to look about how we can make a contribution to help in development.
And how it's sustainable.
How it's sustainable, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You can dig wells, but then what happens when it runs out?
Right. And so that is also teaching the people, if that all goes forward and you put all the, the conversations continue, and as you say, they decide whether a certain country decides whether they're doing it or not. Once they jump on board, then do you help them from that aspect from there with the modeling? You can show them, okay.
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about energy?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. It's an ongoing process. We're very much into building capacities, clearly, because they have to be sustainable.
And talking about building capacities and mentioning the possible, the interest for 60 other reactors, it could be small, could be big. Is the greatest need, for example, like in Africa?
The energy poverty there. Yes, of course. There's a real need. But it's also a number of smaller countries. But Africa's desperate for energy. And they need it for development.
Right.
And they're going to use whatever source they can. If you look at the largest growth in nuclear energy at the moment, you're looking at China, you're looking at India. Enormous populations with enormous energy needs. What are they going to do? Burn fossil fuel? Yes, they're going to continue to burn fossil fuels. They're going to use biomass. They're going to use whatever possible. Renewable.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Great Talk Radio starts here.
But what we need to be taking it forward is making sure it's done as safe as possible. And that's why we come back to where we started. Lessons learned, how to move forward.
And providing that information. And as you said, what was it coming up in September?
Hmm?
Is it the conference coming up in September?
Later this month.
Yeah, later this month. Yeah.
Later this month, 2 weeks' mm-hmm. time in Vienna.
Mm. And that's a big one, obviously, in all of
meeting.
This.
Yeah. And we expect all 151 member states have been invited, the Secretary General, UN, other different agencies, all coming together. and looking at how we're going to move forward on this.
Wow. Jeff Shaw, interesting. You have an interesting job, my friend. Thanks so much for stopping by and spending some time with us here on America Tonight.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
If you're concerned about radiation poisoning from Japan in the air, water, or food and can't find potassium iodide, go to RestoreYourHealthNow.com and choose Liquid Zeolite. Liquid Zeolite is hands down the best product to remove radiation from your body and safely removes toxins, heavy metals, boosts energy levels, and promotes a strong immune system. For fatigue, muscle weakness, headaches, memory loss, influenza, joint pain, or toxic radiation poisoning, use Liquid Zeolite from RestoreYourHealthNow.com. Liquid Zeolite is so powerful it was used to clean up contamination in Chernobyl, yet so gentle you won't even know you're taking it. Liquid Zeolite comes with a money-back guarantee, but is only available at RestoreYourHealthNow.com. Learn how to get free bottles of Liquid Zeolite at RestoreYourHealthNow.com. That's RestoreYourHealthNow.com or call 800-880-9976. Call 800-880-9976 today and learn how to get free bottles of Liquid Zeolite.
Since 2007, the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government have injected as much as $20 trillion into the economies of the world, and yet the globe's economies continue to contract. Our government is borrowing $58,000 per second. If they stop spending, the economy collapses. If they continue spending, the economy collapses. And if they raise interest rates, the economy collapses.
Prepare now.
Call Ready Reserve Foods and put your plan together with quality, storable food. Ready Reserve Foods has been in business canning the finest in dehydrated foods for nearly 40 years. We control the quality from start to finish with double enameled nitrogen-packed cans for maximum shelf life. Choose from a variety of pre-selected packages or customize your own plan and order exactly what you need. Call today for a free catalog at 800-453-2202. That's 1-800-453-2202 or visit ReadyReserveFoods.com. Factory direct, wholesale pricing from ReadyReserveFoods.com.
Where can you find a super strength supplement for thyroid health and thyroid protection? Right here at ThyroidKI.com. Thyroid KI is a super strength potassium iodide supplement formulated to support optimal thyroid health and protection. Thyroid KI is made with only high-grade ingredients and is independently tested for purity. The potassium iodide found in Thyroid KI is absorbed by the thyroid and may offer maximum protection against radioactive iodine exposure. At only $19.90 for a 30-day supply, Thyroid KI is independently tested for purity and is formulated in convenient 32.5 milligram tablets for easy administration in children and adults. Visit ThyroidKI.com. That's thyroid, the letter K, the letter I.com. ThyroidKI.com. Use coupon code GCN for a 10% discount. Again, mention coupon code GCN for 10% off your order. Call 855-599-9444. 855-599-9444. Again, that's 855-599-9444 for Thyroid KI today.
Welcome back to America Tonight, and here we are, and our final guest joining us across from the UN, in fact, at the UN UNICEF facility. And I was jokingly saying to Cheryl Gregory Fay that it's a wonderful day in New York. It is a wonderful day to be here, but it's a very hot day. And Cheryl focuses on girls. She is the senior education advisor at UNICEF New York and heads the UN Girls Education Initiative Secretary, right? So I'll tell you what, this is near and dear to so many of our hearts, so many people who have daughters, so many people who see what's happening in the world with women. What is, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What is the main thrust of what you're focusing on now? I know that's a broad question, but where is your energy going toward in these in issues that affect girls and women ultimately?
Well, as you know, girls and women are the key to the globe. Women hold up more than half of the sky and half of the efforts that go into developing the world. But specifically, we are involved with girls' education because we see girls' education, in fact, as being the silver bullet of absolutely tackling so many of the problems that are confronting the world today. As you know, in many countries, developing countries of the world, children are dying needlessly. There are issues where poverty and exploitation really have become such problems that they've created civil unrest and in some instances even warfare. But education is the key to resolving so much of this. And through research, we have learned that of all of the areas in which we can educate, all of the groups that can benefit from education, we get the greatest return from return on investment from educating girls. And that's because educating girls helps to stimulate economies. The money goes back into the family. Educated girls grow up to have fewer children. Their children turn out to be healthier. Their children wind up getting immunized. They have better employment and other economic opportunities, and it winds up just being a win-win for everyone.
In talking about educating girls, so is the focus on countries who need the leg up, wherever it might be? I mean, some of the third world countries, for example, if you had I'll call it, for lack of a better way to describe it, a hit list of, okay, we're going to attack this area first, then let's go over here. Because it's not to say that there aren't pockets of poverty and many wealthy countries that you could certainly go after and help too. But where's your main focus, like your top three?
Well, certainly in terms of where we work primarily, where we concentrate our efforts, these are the countries that are that have a lot of poverty, countries that are least developed countries, countries also that have high populations and not a sufficient number of girls in school. The world has seen a tremendous evolution in the past 10 years. 10 years ago, there were 100 million children out of school. And two-thirds of those children were girls. Last year, which is the year for which we have the most recent data, we had about 67 million children out of school, and about 54% of those were girls. So you see that we're making tremendous progress. But in reality, the countries that are better off, that are able to invest their own resources, that have better education systems in place, are making more rapid progress than the least developed countries and the countries that have huge populations that require special attention. So the areas where we work the most are in sub-Saharan Africa and in South Asia, largely South and West Asia to a certain extent.
And we're talking about try to get them young, try to get, you know, elementary or just wherever you can step in.
Well, you know, first of all, one of the greatest indicators of whether or not a child's going to go to school and do well in school is the mother's educational level. So if you've got an educated mother, then already the child has a leg up. But beyond that, even children whose parents have not had the opportunity of an education, we try to get as many children as possible involved in early learning, in preschool activities, because preschool also gives children a tremendous advantage in going on to school. Beyond that, we try to target specific interventions that are related to issues like poverty. Children don't go to school. Girls don't go to school sometimes because their parents can't afford school fees. And so you may have specific interventions like scholarships for girls that would help to get children into school. You also have to deal with changing attitudes with regard to parents and communities. Frequently, boys are valued more than girls, mm-hmm. So if you can only afford to send one child to school, then make it the boy. Or you need the girl at home to help to care for the younger siblings or to do other domestic chores. Fetching water can be a huge chore that has to happen in the household, and and the mother needs help, and frequently it's the girl that stays at home to help her mom with that. Other practices like marrying off girls early. Early marriage is a tremendous barrier to girls' education because, in fact, parents believe that by the time a girl hits puberty, that, in fact, she is of marriageable age in a lot of societies. And so, changing that attitude. Making certain that schools are closer to home because parents have greater concerns about the safety and security of their girls than they do of their boys, because boys, it's just a cultural bias that people feel that boys are better able to defend themselves and to protect themselves. So all of these issues conspire in a certain way to keeping girls out of school. And what we do is to try to change the attitudes and also the policies in place in the countries to make certain that that girls do have the opportunity to go.
And so in doing that, fascinating, as you were saying, having to really change those attitudes, especially in doing that, I'm sure there's a delicate balance. Who do you send in? In other words, who's on the ground? Who's on the ground working in some of these areas, especially the two countries you mentioned?
Yes. Well, UNICEF has offices in over 170 countries worldwide, and so we have staff on the ground there that are working in health and in child protection and in education, who provide a technical resource, if you will, with our partners. Now, our primary partner in working on the ground is government. As much as UNICEF invests, as much as the world invests in foreign aid to education in these countries, the governments wind up investing so much more. The overwhelming majority of education budgets in developing countries comes from the government budgets themselves. However, sometimes the right choices aren't made of where resources need to be invested. Sometimes countries are involved in education systems that don't provide the best quality. And quality issues also conspire to keep children out of school. If a child goes to school and feels stigmatized or discriminated against for whatever reason, if the teacher's not being fair with certain categories of children because they happen to be girls or because of other factors, these are issues that, you know, that we're working with governments, with teachers' associations, with parents' associations, with nonprofit agencies, to try to address so that all children will have the opportunities that they deserve to a quality education.
Yeah, we have a minute and a half or so left. What's been the most rewarding part of this for you? Are you seeing some progress?
Oh, absolutely. We are able to see girls that are the first in their generation ever to go to school. I remember the case of one girl in particular in Uganda whose parents had never been to school, who was able to go to school through a special scholarship program. She went into elementary school. She managed to do quite well. She went into secondary school. She continued to do quite well. She managed to win a place at the university and got a full scholarship, graduated from university, and just the pride that she showed, the hope, the enthusiasm, what she can do to contribute to her nation,
right,
the pride of her family and her community in her accomplishments. That's what it's all about.
And there you go. Cheryl, thanks so much for stopping by. We appreciate it. Speak for many people probably listening to the show. We appreciate the hard work that you're doing, and keep making a difference.
Thank you so much.